This is a perfect storm of conspiracy theories.
On December 15th, 2017, Canadian billionaires Honey and Barry Sherman were found dead in their mansion. To this day, the case remains unsolved.
Counterfeit and copied pharmaceuticals was much more lucrative than heroin, cocaine, and the rest of it.
If you live by the sword, you die by the sword.
Listen to the no good, terribly kind, wonderful lives and tragic deaths of Barry and Honey Sherman, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Matt Galloway, and this is The Current Podcast.
This remains, an enormous concern. Infecting ducks and chickens, but now increasingly mammals, that virus now evolves and develops the ability to infect humans, and then critically the ability to go from human to human transmission.
An enormous concern. That is Jeremy Farrar, the chief scientist for the World Health Organization, and he's talking about H5N1, a bird flu virus. This virus is decimating wild bird populations and, as you heard, has jumped to some mammals. Now it's also infecting livestock. So far, the virus has shown up in more than 30 herds of cattle in the United States, and there have been two cases reported in humans in the U.S. Helen Branswell covers infectious diseases and global health for the health news website Stat. Helen, good morning.
Hi, Matt.
Well, maybe it's just me, but a warning like that from the WHO has a little bit of deja vu to it. Does it to you?
Oh, yeah, certainly. I mean, for one thing, Jeremy Farrar was in Vietnam in 2003, 2004, and for several years after that, when this virus really started to take off. So he knows it very well. He's been watching it forever. And, it does feel a little bit like some of the discussions we've been having for years. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just give us, I mean, you hinted at this, but just give us a little bit of a primer or a primer, however you want to say it. Where did the H5N1 virus first appear?
Okay, so H5N1 was first spotted in a goose in Guangdong, China in 1996. That's kind of not so important, but the next year, out of the blue, Hong Kong reported that it had found 18 infections in small children, six of whom died. I mean, and that was really startling because up until then, it had been thought that avian viruses couldn't infect people, that humans were only infectable with H1, H2, and H3 flu viruses. Mm. So people get really concerned. There was concern that this might cause a pandemic, and then it died down and went away seemingly for a few years, although clearly was still in poultry, just not spotted. And then just after the SARS outbreak of 2003, it reemerged in Southeast Asia and started sort of burning across Southeast Asia, East Asia, eventually getting into North Africa, Egypt. And for years there, decimated poultry flocks and occasionally infected people. And when it infected people, it typically had a very high fatality rate, somewhere around 50, 60%.
What have we seen in terms of how birds spread it? I mean, the spring migratory season is just about underway or underway right now. What is going on?
Yeah, so you know, it has been around for a long time and it has changed a lot. And so the virus that was going through Asia in the aughts has picked up some internal genes from North American wild birds that allows it to spread really, really well in wild bird populations. And that's a problem because it means there's just a ton of it out in the environment. So, you know, your listeners might have heard that a polar bear was found having been infected with H5N1, and coyotes have been found.
There's these
and
images of these elephant seals in Argentina, this mass die-off of elephant seals.
Exactly. So what's happening is wild birds are getting infected, dying, being scavenged upon by all sorts of other species, mammalian species, and that is transferring the infection to mammals. In some cases, it looks like there's spread amongst the mammals. Often it's just, you know, the one that encounters it dies, the thing about the virus getting into mammals that concerns everybody is that, you know, we're mammal. Mm-hmm. And if it stays in a mammal population and starts to acquire mutations that allow it to spread within that population, some of those mutations could make it better adapted to being able to jump to people and spread within the human population.
We've talked on this program about what's happening on poultry farms, where in the States, something like 90 million birds have died. A lot of that has been culling to stop the virus. That's happening here in Canada as well. And now we're hearing, and I said this in the introduction, that this virus has been found in something like 30 herds of cattle in the United States.
Yeah, it's, you know, the last update was Monday. They said 33 in 8 states, but it's believed to be quite a bit wider spread than that number would indicate.
The Food and Drug Administration in the United States yesterday said that samples of pasteurized milk from around that country had tested positive for inactive remnants of the bird flu virus. You said, and other people have been talking about this, that more info on this would be useful. What more info are you looking for?
Well, you know, they've been pressed for a while now to indicate what kind of testing they're doing. And I, you know, what I've heard is that they were very reluctant to release the results because they were concerned that they would be misunderstood. So when they released them sort of at end of day in a very long statement that was very long on sort of assurances, it was very short on details. They didn't talk about how many samples they had taken, how many were positive amongst the samples they had taken. They didn't talk about whether they had tested exclusively in areas around, you know, farms that have been known to have the infection, or if they were testing in parts of the country where the virus hasn't been detected.
I mean, misunderstanding is largely about the fact that people wonder whether it's safe to drink milk or eat eggs or
right,
you know, chicken
right,
or yeah, beef or what have you.
Yeah. And you know, it is very important to say that what they found was evidence that at some point that milk had H5N1 virus in it. But that doesn't mean that that virus is alive and able to potentially infect somebody who consumes that milk. It is more likely, given that, you know, milk bought in stores is pasteurized, that it was inactivated by the pasteurization. But they weren't super clear about what their studies have shown about that. I mean, they said that their assessment of the risk has not changed, but they didn't really give a lot of detail. And of course, there is a, you know, consumption of raw milk is discouraged for all sorts of reasons, but there is a market for raw milk, and that opens other questions.
Our friend, the Canadian virologist Angela Rasmussen, said on social media, "We know that if you don't want an outbreak to become an epidemic or a pandemic, it needs to be contained quickly. This news of what's going on and the lack of information that you're hinting at, shows that neither has been contained and there's no evident rush to do so." What's not going on, do you think?
You know, it's always interesting to see a situation where the interests of the agriculture sector interact with the interests of human health. You know, agriculture is massive business, and it's a really important industry. And there are often concerns that exploring things too hard could lead to answers you don't want to find, I guess. You know, I think there is concern that farmers may not be interested in having their cows tested. Certainly, one hears that there may have been other farm workers who had symptoms like the case you referred to in the intro, the man, an individual in Texas who had conjunctivitis, and that was he tested positive for H5. There may be more of those, but in the U.S. anyway, a lot of the workers in farm operations are migrant workers, and they may be afraid of interactions with officialdom, if you know what I mean.
Mm. I'm going to let you go, but just finally and briefly, knowing what you know, what concerns you the most about this right now?
I don't like the lack of transparency. I don't feel like there's enough being done to try to figure out how widespread the problem is. And I don't like the fact that the virus is in a mammal species that humans have a fair amount of interactions with. We don't get nose to nose with seals. People do get nose to nose with cats.
Helen, good to talk to you as always. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
Helen Branswell covers infectious diseases and global health for the health news website STAT.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share 2 hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
As you can imagine, cattle and dairy farmers here in Canada are paying close attention to what's going on with bird flu outbreaks in the United States. Thus far, there are no known cattle cases in Canada. Raquel Koloff is a cattle farmer on the Sunshine Coast in British Columbia.
I'm more concerned for what it's going to do for the cattle industry as a whole in BC. I have a closed herd, which means the cattle on my farm live and die here. So I'm not at high risk of getting it. I also don't feed any poultry waste or poultry litter to my cattle, which is the cause of several cases in the States. They were feeding poultry barn litter back to cows, which is a no-no. And in Canada, that's not allowed. So while I believe that me personally, my cattle won't get bird flu, I do believe that everyone in Canada is at risk because of how quickly it spread in the States and now it's gone to mammals. So I think if there are cases in Canada, it affects us all. Our whole industry gets shut down.
Koloff says she is encouraged in the face of all of that by how well Canadian officials are communicating with farmers.
The Ministry of Agriculture here and the head vet has done a great job putting on lots of seminars through different organizations on teaching farmers about the signs and symptoms of bird flu, how we're not to share water where there are migratory waterfowl. They should not be sharing water with any of our commercial birds. And if we have a suspected case, we can send the dead animal to the Animal Health Center for testing at a reduced cost. So that's huge because you need to know what you're dealing with. If you have a sick animal, you need to know what the illness is so you can take the appropriate precautions and treat accordingly.
Human cases of bird flu are less common. As we mentioned, there have only ever been 2 recorded human cases in the United States, only 1 in Canada, and that was over a decade ago. Dr. Isaac Bogosh is an infectious diseases physician at Toronto General Hospital. Dr. Bogosh, good morning.
Good morning, Matt.
Big picture, what are you watching for right now when it comes to H5N1?
I think Helen hit the nail on the head here. The real issue here is that we're seeing more cases in mammals. We don't want to see more cases in mammals because there's opportunities for the virus to mutate and be more transmissible between mammals. Of course, humans are mammals. And of course, humans have much more close contact with cattle than we do with other wild mammals. So looking at the mutations in mammalian species, especially cattle, to see if there's more effective transmission between mammals. Obviously, that increases the opportunity for spillover events. Not only are we concerned about the agricultural sector, but of course, we're concerned about humans, us. We don't want to get this. And as was pointed out, this is a rather lethal infection. And we really want to ensure that it remains not very easily transmitted between mammals, including humans.
We heard what farmers are doing. Are there things that the rest of us should be doing to take extra precautions? I remember, and this was, I guess, last year or maybe the year before when there was discussion around this. People were concerned about, for example, contact with bird feeders because of migratory birds.
Yeah. So like 2 things. Obviously, we have to timestamp our conversations. You know, let's timestamp this to April of 2024, where we currently have 0 cases of human H5N1 infection in the country. And, you know, during your day-to-day life, listen, it's always a good idea to not pick up a dead bird, regardless of if it's today or tomorrow or 5 years ago. It's always a good idea not to handle dead or dying wild animals. So like nothing really changes. Bird feeders, sure, of course, you can be careful around those. But in general, you know, there's not much that individuals would do in their day-to-day lives. This is something that's being very closely watched by the public health sector, the animal health sector, scientists, etc. But for the general public in April of 2024, there's really not much to change.
Can I ask just a couple of, I mean, maybe these are dumb questions, but is there a way to test for H5N1 in humans?
Yeah.
Like rapid testing, like we had for COVID, like does that work?
So it's still an influenza virus, and it's still influenza A. So most of our tests should work, but it's not exactly the same as our seasonal influenza. So it's not entirely clear to what degree those tests would pick it up. They probably would ding positive, but it's not entirely clear what the true sensitivity and specificity is. But what happens is when those tests are positive, if there's anything unusual, a lot of those times the tests are sent to a reference laboratory to say, hey, this is regular seasonal influenza, or is this a different type of influenza? And that's how we know if it's H5N1.
What about vaccines? We've talked on this program about vaccines for poultry, given the devastating effect that it's having on poultry farms. What about vaccines for humans for something like this?
Yeah, that's really interesting because, you know, this, as was discussed, this has epidemic and pandemic potential. We currently have zero cases in humans in Canada. But of course, if this acquires the mutations to be more readily transmitted between people, and this does cause, God forbid, an epidemic or even worse, a pandemic, you would need vaccines to combat it. The United States has a stockpile of vaccines. They have millions and millions of vaccines that are tailored towards avian influenza. It's not entirely clear to what extent those vaccines would be effective against this particular clade. That's like a type of H5N1. It's to be technical, the clade is 2344B. That's the one that's circulating now. There's some discussion that some of the vaccines available in the United States may have some protective efficacy, but it's not entirely clear. Mm. Canada does not have a stockpile, but you know, many high-income countries have agreements with vaccine manufacturers that in the God forbid instance that there is an epidemic or a pandemic, we would have priority access, which kind of reminds us of conversations we had 3 years ago regarding the equity of vaccines for a global health emergency. So, you know, there's a lot of questions right now. You know, is there enough vaccine supply? Is there the production capacity globally? Who would have priority access? So many of the same questions we had during COVID-19 still linger with when we think about H5N1.
Let me just ask you a couple of questions before we go. We just have a couple of minutes left. One is, we asked Public Health Agency of Canada about this, and they sent us a statement. It reads in part, "The risk of getting avian influenza A is low for the general public who has limited contact with infected animals." Goes on to talk about the surveillance system, which is established for emerging respiratory diseases. How prepared do you think Canada is post-COVID to deal with something like this? I mean, part of this is about, like, what did we learn?
So the short answer is, I don't know. The more nuanced answer is, we're probably better off than we were before COVID, but it's not entirely clear how much better off, right? What are our surveillance systems in place? Are they adequate? Have they really been tested? You know, what would our response be? A lot of this too, I think there's the medical side of things, but you never want to think about another pandemic just after what we've been through. Yeah. But it's an important thought process. What about the psychosocial aspect of this? And I think, like anything else, we always have to include behavioral science.
Trust in public health, for example.
Trust in public health, God forbid. You know, and remember, listen, people are going to skewer me for this, but, you know, COVID was a devastating infection, but it was far more devastating in older populations than in younger populations, far more, okay? But influenza has what we call a U-shaped curve. Influenza crushes children and the elderly, whereas COVID disproportionately crushed the elderly. What would happen in a case where there was a deadly pandemic with something that was so deadly to children? Mm. You have to have those conversations again about masks and masking in schools. And, you know, God forbid we even talk about school closures. And again, I'm not saying this is going to happen. I'm not saying this is, you know, right around the corner. But, you know, I think as a society, we have to have some conversations and, of course, involve behavioral scientists to see what is our appetite for future, you know, potential, hopefully low potential, but future potential pandemics.
And so just in a couple of seconds, for somebody who says, no, thank you, not today, I don't want to hear about this, what would your answer be?
We have to be the mature adults in the room and at least have the conversations to get the sense of what Canadians want to do. Obviously, this is a democracy, and the pandemic response has to protect the public, but also has to reflect the will of the people as well.
Isaac, good to talk to you as always. Thank you very much.
Have a good one.
Dr. Isaac Bogosh is an infectious diseases physician at Toronto General Hospital.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.